meditation practice from a sense of releasing ourselves from the day's activities. And we just don't carry the thoughts of the day with us. We don't hold ourselves. If everybody could turn off their pagers and their cell phones. And we just release ourselves from the entanglements, the unfinished conversation, the difficult exchange at work, or whatever might have occurred. The point and fruit of the practice is in refreshing ourselves moment after moment, not with carrying things over and mulling over them. And as soon as you allow yourself to release that inward activity, suddenly we find the moment of here and now very available to us. Suddenly our senses become awake. We hear the sounds that up until this point we didn't notice at all. We begin to notice how our body feels. We begin to notice inwardly what attitude we might be carrying. And we make a statement of staying right here and now through our body posture. A slumped body posture can tend to signify a burden or a lethargy or a defeat. A straight body posture with the shoulders back may well represent an inward psychic posture of renewal and openness and inclusion. And so the body posture is a very important component of how we sit. Now I'm going to walk you through key areas of the body to relax, because the foundation of the meditation comes from a sense of relaxation and renewal. And we do not relax in this practice by sending our mind on some adventure that is irrespective of where the body is located. We align our mind in our body. So softening the eyes, keeping the eyes closed, or downcast and focused on one point if it's uncomfortable for you to close your eyes. Loosening the jaw so the teeth aren't clenched. Moving the shoulders away from the neck and back so they're not rounded. And softening the belly itself so that there is an effortlessness in the breathing and with the breathing. When there's anxiety or tension, you'll find that the belly doesn't move with the breath. What we are looking for is on the in-breath, the abdominal area expanding, and on the exhalation, it contracts. And you can feel the movement as physical sensation of that swinging door of the breath moving in and expanding the belly, and then the exhalation, the contraction of the belly. And that's one of the two areas that we can focus and rest our attention upon. The other area that some people choose is the area at the nose tip, as the air passes in and out of the nostrils. There is a slight sensation that that makes. I would suggest, if you're indecisive, to go to the belly, because it is farther away from the head and the thinking. And when you're at the nose tip, you're too close to the mind. And the activity of the mind may cover over the very feeling of sensation of breath itself. So staying very grounded in the belly. And as the body becomes more relaxed, we just stay with the breath, the feeling and sensation of the breath. At the beginning of the breath, on the very first sensation of in-breath, through the middle of the breath, and then through the exhalation, the beginning of the exhalation, the middle of the exhalation, and the end of the exhalation. Just resting our attention like a raft on the ocean, not clutching or grasping after sensation, but resting. If you picture a raft on the ocean, it picks up the subtle waves beneath the raft are felt as sensation, as movement. And so too, we're just releasing our tension and just settling in with the sensation of breath. And very quickly, the mind will lose itself in thought. It has learned to think itself away from the here and now. It has learned to use the noise of thought to buffer the immediate impact of the here and now. And because the breath represents an anchor and a tether to the here and now, you will find yourself pulling again and again at that tether with thinking, through thinking. And you'll think and think, and then all of a sudden you'll realize you're not on your breath. And you'll think about your breath. Well, why am I not on my breath? Why should I go back to my breath? This is much nicer to be lost in thought. Wherever it is that you realize that you haven't been on your breath, it is there that you release the thought. Release it, and then first go back to the sense of physical relaxation. The sense of physical relaxation is the basis of the practice. And then from that sense of physical relaxation, allow the breath to emerge. The sense of physical relaxation will dissipate anything we might be carrying over in terms of our attitude or self-doubt, and allow us to regain a fresh and new contact with the breath. Remember that the definition of meditation is knowing what's occurring. Knowing breathing is arising. Knowing breathing is occurring. If we don't know that we are breathing, then we are lost in thought and therefore not meditating. It's very clear. The light is either on or it's off. We're either noticing what's occurring, or we have lost ourselves within the realm of thinking. This week I add another dimension to the practice. As we're sitting, resting our attention upon the breath, if a physical sensation should arise that predominates over the breath, be it a feeling of tingling or heat or cold or an itch, or perhaps more frequently pain, we can take our mind off the breath and place it on that physical sensation with the same degree of care and attention we were giving the breath. We're no longer holding ourselves to the breath. We are now fully and completely attentive to whatever the competing physical sensation is, like pain or an itch. And then we just rest our attention there. Don't struggle with it. We don't try to change it. We don't try to get rid of it. We don't judge it. We just allow it to be just as it is. And then when it becomes less predominant or subsides, we can come back to the breath. The breath is our home plate, to which we can return when there aren't any competing and more predominant physical sensations that are occurring. And this way, a physical sensation that is unpleasant, like pain, will not keep competing against your meditation as an annoyance. And this way, the very annoyance itself becomes the meditation. And as we will learn in the weeks to follow, that every play of mind and body experience will become the meditation. But for now, we're staying very grounded in the body, very grounded in physical sensation, the breath, an itch, a pain. If it's helpful to label very softly what it is that you're noticing, being on the breath, rising, falling, rising, falling, and then an itch occurs, itch, itch, and then a pain, 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 and then those subside, rising, falling, rising, falling. The point of using labels is to acknowledge the experience that we're observing, to keep the mind focused and pointed on what is actually happening, not to get lost and wonder whether we're offering the right label to the sensation. Well, is this really pain? It feels more like an itch. Or maybe just be very simple with the label. They are tools to help us meet and make contact with the sensation. So staying very simple, remember the words relaxation, noticing what's happening, knowing breath is occurring, knowing pain is arising, knowing an itch is occurring. Staying very grounded in the immediacy of the moment, not thoughts about the moment. At the end of each sitting, I'll read a poem. So please continue to meditate as I read this. It's Mary Oliver. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? May all beings consider the purpose to living. May all beings look into the meaning of their life. May all beings take their lives seriously. So opening your eyes. So this week we introduced a new level into the instruction. We opened to a new field of our experience. What we'll find that over the course of the weeks we'll open up to every facet of the mind and body experience. Emotions, feelings, sounds, sights. So that at the end of these 6 weeks together in the day long, virtually nothing that comes into the mind and body through the senses will be outside of our ability to notice and to meditate upon it. And that way there will never be a distraction, there'll never be an upsetting emotion, there'll never be an attitude that will drive you into reckless behavior, there'll never be an emotion or anything that doesn't allow you to recover it through your ability to attend. Once we attend upon something, we bring it into the sphere of our influence. By that I mean, when it's not attended to, it's behind the scene driving us, be it an attitude or an emotion or even an itch. And unless we know that it's occurring, we have no influence to bear upon it. We can't open to it. We can't allow it. We are driven by our reactions to it. And what you'll notice is that as we begin to make the body more accessible to you, like tonight, by opening up the field of our attention to include other physical sensations besides just the breath, that mostly what other physical sensations you will feel will be unpleasant. And mostly we are driven to reacting to these unpleasant sensations absent-mindedly, unconsciously. Itching, scratching, moving, wiggling, restlessness. And now what we're asked to do is not to wiggle, because we're taking a very formal, straight, yet relaxed posture, and attend to them so that we don't react from them, but we allow them to come within the field of our attention without judging them, without condemning them, without trying to change them in any way. If we can master our ability to attend to unpleasant sensations when they occur, rather than what our tendency has been in the past to flee unpleasant sensations, if the relationship gets tough, I'm out of it. If the room's too hot, I'm in all sorts of uncomfortable behaviors trying to get the temperature adjusted just right. If my body aches, I'm taking medication. And there may be some legitimate reasons to do all of that. But for us to know that we're doing it, to bring it into the sphere of conscious behavior, is a large part of what this meditation points. So that we're not driven by anything. So that everything is known to us. Can you imagine what that would mean? I mean, maybe you're just starting to imagine what that can mean. But you would be dumbfounded to follow yourself through the day and to realize what it is and how it is you react, what it is that defines the behavior you take. You would just be amazed. It's an emotion that I can't feel, that I can't hold on to, and I'm reacting, I'm angry. And my anger is directed externally because I'm unable to hold the internal feeling of the emotion. So whoever is in the field of my behavior gets the anger addressed at him or her rather than for me to be accountable to that emotion and be able to hold it for myself. And we'll go into that all next week. But I just want to give you a sense this week of what we're doing. What I want to do is talk about some of the preliminary understandings, the preliminary lessons of life that have to be in place. You have to align yourself to life in a particular way for this meditation to work, or for the Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, the truth of things, the Buddha's teaching, the truth of things, for you to understand the Dharma. If we keep reacting to life and fleeing from it, moving towards what we enjoy and away from what we are aversive towards, we never allow life to express or to be seen just the way it is. We're always out of there if it's an unpleasant sensation and trying to grasp and hold on and make it last longer if it's a pleasant one. Mostly what we try to do is to reach kind of a neutral territory where nothing is particularly happening. We think the difficulties we're facing in our life are just momentary problems, and that the real purpose of life is to get over these humps so that we can reach some kind of a flat land, like a flat EEG. We're really looking for death. Let me read what one person says about this. For a long time, it seemed to me that life was about to begin, real life. But there was always some obstacle in the way, something to be got over first, some unfinished business, time still to be served, a debt to be paid. Then life would begin. At last, it dawned on me that these obstacles were my life. How many decades have we lived thinking that if we can just get over this problem, then everything will be okay? And perhaps we do get over that problem, and we have a duration of a few days, maybe hours if we're lucky, but maybe days, until the next one hits, and we're off kilter. And we're always looking at the challenges as something outside of the living experience itself. This is the way we live. Here's what Jerry Seinfeld says. We use a lot of different sources in our... Life is truly a ride. We're all strapped in and no one can stop it. When the doctor slaps your behind, he's ripping your ticket and away you go. As you make each passage from youth to adulthood to maturity, sometimes you put your arms up and scream. Sometimes you just hang on to the bar in front of you. But the ride is the thing. I think the most you can hope for at the end of life is that your hair is messed up, you're out of breath, and you haven't thrown up. So what is the orientation to life that would allow it to not be an obstacle and a hindrance that's constantly plaguing and upon us, constantly wearing us down, where we get constantly discouraged and despairing, where we're held within our loneliness in almost a desperate kind of way, like that somewhat pitiful song years ago that says, "Is that all there is? Is this all there is?" And after decades of living, we realize it's never going to be a utopia. But God, is this all there is? Have you ever felt that? There must be a new orientation, a new direction, a new way that we can work with the obstacles, with what's in front of us, so that they're workable, so they're manageable, so that they actually feed our intention and our purpose for living, so they actually strengthen us, allow us to grow in relationship to them rather than be depleted by them. So what are those lessons, these preliminary lessons that are so essential for that right orientation to life? The first is that facts are friendly. Facts are friendly. Mark Twain said, "Get your facts first, and then you can distort them all you want." We don't get the facts first. We don't get the facts first. The facts, whatever is going inside of me, whatever the experience is the fact. We usually try to arrange the facts to suit us. Let me just give you a very stark and real example. How about the fact of your death? How many of us in the room have included that fact in our life? An easy example would be, how many of us have advance directives or living wills or even a will? Well, I'm only 30. Well, you've never worked at a hospice program where the census is punctuated with people your age. And we just have a certain relationship to life in which we are blind or just hold life at bay. This is not going to happen to me. Or when some difficulty does, instead of addressing it and using it for the purpose of our growth, we blame it, which is the knee-jerk response towards getting this thing out from under my responsibility and placing it on you. It's also called projection. What I don't like in myself, I take and place it on a particular ethnic group or whatever, and then I can hate you instead of hating me because I own this particular quality. That's called prejudice. You see, mostly what we do when we really examine, and this is the key point, we live an unexamined life, Socrates said, isn't worth living. Because an unexamined life is just a reaction to the incidences that are occurring. There's no awareness. There's no nobility in it. It's just a hot potato moving from one hand to another. And it's because we haven't learned how to be able to know that facts are ultimately friendly, that facts, regardless of what those facts are, actually support us. In fact, how could they not? How could the facts in our life be against our life? What, doesn't it make absolute sense that if we oriented ourselves to those facts and opened to them, that we would grow in relationship to them? But when we close down and revolt or blame them away and not take responsibility for them, there's no growth whatsoever in relationship to those. And that's why many of us have found ourselves in patterns, relationship patterns again and again and again, job patterns again and again and again, same patterns arising over and over and over again because we have learned very little about it. We keep blaming it on the boss. We keep blaming it on, well, how, no one could live with her. And if you had a mother like I, you couldn't live with me. When are we going to allow really the maturity to say enough of this? Really enough of this. We're bleeding. I mean, you can see it. You can see it as a culture, as a society, as virtually everything we do, rather than be able to hold the experience of what we're feeling, we point fingers. Would somebody, one of the, not, no, one, that's it. Diane, would you go, please?
I did earlier.
Okay. Okay. So facts are friendly. Facts ultimately invite us to open to them. And that's what our orientation is in this meditation. The orientation in this meditation is to take the simple facts that are occurring on our body, physical sensations. We're not going too far. This is only week two. We're going to deal with the difficulties of the pain and the itch. Not the boss and the girlfriend. Okay, we're starting just basic here. We're starting right, okay, so an itch. But if we catch it at that level, it's amazing how we see the same responses as the level becomes more intense, as the level becomes more complex. It's the same. So if we work with it at the level, okay, an itch, let me just feel what an itch feels like. Let me just Okay, instead of just immediately rubbing it out, murdering it, let me feel it. Let me just, okay, what's it going to do but make you itch? Okay, the pain, now that's a little more difficult, isn't it? But listen to this, it's exactly the same. It's not the pain, it's not the physical sensation itself, it's the fear of it. It's not what is occurring, it's what we anticipate what is occurring becoming. So that's a mental response, not a physical one. The first level is that it's unpleasant. Yes, it's unpleasant. You're never going to make pain pleasant. You can stare at it for the rest of your life. It will remain unpleasant. But what we do is we take the unpleasant and then we recoil back from it in contraction, in fear, in anticipation of this. And then the thoughts pour forth that say, this is the old wound that I had in high school that's acting up again. And if I don't change postures immediately, I'm never going to be able to walk. Or something to that effect. And soon we're wiggling. Now, let me just give you a rule of thumb. Everyone who ever sits, no matter what position, is going to have pain. You could lie down on 6 feet of foam. You could be the princess in the pea. And wiggle because the pee under 20 mattresses. So it's never going to be so the body doesn't hurt. The body's going to hurt. Any of you who are over the age of 40 know that. So the question is, what do we do with that? You know, you could spend all week in a gym. And it still wouldn't make any difference. Your body would still hurt. Probably hurt worse. Can I feel the pain without letting the thoughts, because we're learning something here, not letting my thoughts take this pain and make it something that it isn't. Because it's only my thoughts, my anticipation of where this pain is going, that's the problem, not where it is. So if we can rest on just feeling it, and then if you start feeling yourself get, you know, irritable about it and annoyed, then just move the leg. It's fine. Or rub the sore. It's not, you're not losing anything. You're fine. But just stay a few seconds where you think you've reached your limit. Just stay a few seconds beyond that. So you can see your limit is artificially induced. Facts are friendly. They really are. And as we begin to realize that we can uncover the facts of our life and make them workable, our whole life becomes workable. And suddenly the problems that are everyday problems that we face are no longer problems. They're challenges. They're things that require some reflection, some alignment. But we can work on them in a way that allows us to grow in relationship and proportionally to it. And this includes our death. Includes our death. So that's the first preliminary lesson. The second lesson is that you can trust your experience. What we are doing here in meditation is beginning to bring bare attention to the experiences we're having. Now, bare attention is just that. It doesn't have a judgment associated with it or an opinion or a conclusion about it. It's not colored by anything that we have known before. It is just this situation, my breath, the physical pain, the itch, and just bringing attention, clear, pristine attention to it. And we can trust that. We can trust that I have the capacity to be able to hold this experience. We don't trust. We think the reason we flee from our experience is we think it will overwhelm us. If I open up to my anger and really feel it, or feel my fear, or feel my annoyance or my loneliness or my impatience, well, then I will be dragged down to the depths of where that emotion is going to take me. Not true. See how much courage this takes? It takes enormous courage to do this because every cell in our body wants to flee it. And yet, to have the capacity just to hold it, each of us have that capacity. I can feel this. I can feel this. And not bring anything to it. Like, oh, this is what my mother and father used to be. And I remember how my father got out of control when he felt, you know, all of that history. That's just past coloration of a present moment. What we want to do is bear the present moment just raw and naked. So that it's just this new, never experienced this before. Let me feel, what is this feeling? I can hold this. The ability to hold, awareness has the capacity to hold everything. Awareness, as a metaphor, as an analogy, is like the air around you. You can bring the same quality of what the air does to your body, to your inside. It just has the ability to surround, to highlight, to reveal. Okay. And so we can trust our experience. That's the second preliminary lesson that is essential for our growth. The first is that facts are friendly. The second is that I have the capacity to hold these facts. And that if I do so, I will allow life to touch me because these facts are life. These facts are the expression of our living experience and we're letting them in. And so we're aligning ourselves with life. You might think of it as like the Sistine Chapel, where the hand of God and the hand of humankind is just connecting. When we let a fact in, the fingers touch. It's life. It's not somebody doing something to me. It's not bad luck. No matter what the facts are, it's not bad luck. Cancer, it's not bad luck. It's not bad luck. So the third preliminary lesson is that others' ideas about life are not a guide for me. Now that's a hard one because we, as a culture, are very dependent upon the knowledge of others for our guidance. And we really have our most esteemed leadership in our universities. Certainly not in government. And yet, we have raised knowledge and learning to such a pinnacle, but we haven't raised wisdom to the same pinnacle. And wisdom is what this practice is directed towards. Not abstract knowledge, but direct integrated learning from life directly. That's why we're taking thought out of the equation for these early weeks. We say, don't think about your experience, because when you think about your experience, you put your whole backlog of information between you and the experience. And then you're just running from that already understood fact, and you're not learning anything new. You're just running from your reactivity and from your previous knowledge. So eliminate all that and bring your attention and contact to bear upon just the experience as it is. Just this. And without thinking about it. And then we can feel this experience as something new, as something a beginner's mind, it said in Zen meditation. Beginner's mind. That's what it's meant, beginner's mind. We aren't bringing our opinions about, we're just, okay, let me feel this. I can feel it for the first time. Each time I feel my breath, it's for the first time. So no one can guide us in that. I mean, I can, as a teacher in this practice, I can say, this is something, watch out for this. Up ahead, this will occur. I can give you all kinds of roadmaps, which can be helpful, but every single one of us have to walk it. That's what's interesting, is that the Buddha solved his problem, he didn't solve ours. Each one of us have to walk the same path. We have to come to the same truths. We have to open to the same wisdom. We have to learn the same tactical strategies in our life in order to make it work. You can't just read a book and expect to know it. Initially, reading a book gives you some sort of enthusiasm and high, but then it doesn't last. It doesn't, because it's not integrated knowledge, it just remains up here in the abstract. What we want to do is to integrate it. You see, this is insight meditation. It's through insight that the knowledge is integrated. When you really see something, as if for the first time, whoa, I realize, I see it. There's my pain and then there's fear. Those aren't the same things. You see that and your life has changed from then on. Every time you have pain from then on, you know that that's different than the fear response to it. And that's just one very small example of infinite number of insights available. So others' ideas about life are not a guide for us. Okay, now growth, this is the next preliminary lesson. Growth and learning are always possible within experience. No matter what the experience is, there's a possibility of growing from it. Or, as most or many of us do, there's also the possibility of becoming further embedded and enmeshed in the pain of that experience, in which case that will lead to bitterness and cynicism. And you can see in your life which way you've gone. Just look at yourself. I mean, so many people who have had one bad experience with their spouse dismiss the whole 50% of the population of that gender. Men are. Women always. I mean, that's cynicism and bitterness. Or is it possible to stay open here? And to grow and learn from each experience, which doesn't mean we're naive, doesn't mean that we keep hitting our head against the same wall every single time because we keep choosing the wrong mate. We see that and we learn and we adjust who it is that we choose. And we aren't driven by the patterns of a lifetime. So growth and learning are always possible within experience. Now here, this preliminary lesson is a very important one and is really at the basis of the Buddhist teaching. All of these are at the basis of the Buddhist teaching. Suffering is not whimsical. It's not the universe dumping on you. Suffering is not whimsical. There is a cause and the release from it. Okay, so let's examine what the cause of suffering is. Not hardship, not difficulty, not challenges. You have an earthquake, there's not some esoteric reason the earthquake occurred. Suffering is in our relationship to what's occurring. We decide we want to go on a picnic on Saturday morning. We've got it all planned, mapped out, reservations. We wake up on Saturday morning and it's raining. How quickly can we come and align ourselves to the fact, listen to the words, to the fact that it's raining, rather than to hold on to the imaginative belief and memory that I really wanted to go on this picnic today? Because the gap between our ability to adjust ourselves to the reality of the fact will determine how quickly we end our suffering. And the distance and how much we play upon and maintain the imaginative reality, oh, I really wanted it to, really wanted this to happen, that distance will determine how much we suffer. And this, you can put every equation of your life into this particular example. Recently, well, it wasn't recently, it was 10 months ago, I got tennis elbow. And it was an annoyance. And I got impatient with it. And I just aggravated it. And it's just an annoyance. And then I started to get some help for it. Went to a PT and a massage therapist, and they kept saying, you know, you've got to take care of this thing. So, okay, wait a second. As long as I didn't want it to be there, as long as it was an annoyance, it was the memory of how my arm used to work was in comparison to how it was working. And the distance to that was an irritation, annoyance, and I hated it. I hated the problem. The faster I woke up to the that this is it, this is the state of affairs here, and I've got to, then when it did become the state of affairs, using the previous example, I realized it was raining on Saturday morning. Then you start caring for it. Oh, okay, I've got to take care of it. Then your heart connects. See, the heart connects in relationship. It doesn't connect in annoyance. When we really care about it, we care about it. When we want it to, suddenly it's a part of me again. Not a hindrance to something being a part of me. So when we acknowledge and open to something, we're affected by it. And when you're affected by something, that means you have greater sensitivity to life. And when there's greater sensitivity to life, it means the heart is more involved in the living experience. And when the heart is more involved in the living experience, the implications are caring, affection, compassion, warm-heartedness, kindness, patience. How can it not be? So we need, in summation, to get back on track, to realign ourselves with the central purpose of what our life has always and only been about, which was to face what's in front of ourselves and open to it. Accommodate the reality of the moment. Say yes and not resist what is at hand. Just to allow what is here to be. In fact, I could sum up the whole of the meditation by saying, relax and say yes to your experience. Just allow it to be what it is, without judging it, condemning it, identifying with it. Just allow it to be. And therein rests the Buddha's teaching. Can we sit for a moment or two? And unfortunately, I think I lost some of the talk because I wasn't paying attention to the tape recorder. I've got a lot of things that I have to. So, but you will, the tapes will be available on the web for those people. If you'd like to review it or hear it again, please do so. You can download it. It's free. The homework will be up there. So let's get to the homework. Okay. Sit 30 minutes a day, everybody. First of all, this is the last week that new people can start. No new people after this week. Sit 30 minutes a day, sometime, if you can possibly manage it, into your life, try to sit 30 minutes a day. Don't be brittle with it. I mean, don't be a, you know, we're not trying to butcher you here. We're trying to encourage the practice. So if one day you miss, okay, the next day you can start again. But try to do that. Yes. No. We want 30 continuous. And the reason is this, and that's a good question. The first week I would have allowed it, but we're into the second week now, because really it takes about 30 minutes for the body to settle down and not just think itself to death, all right? And you'll find that at about that length of time, right before the bell gets up, you'll may be able to stay one or two times on a breath, okay? So practice it as continuous as you can. Again, not to make it so, so you're full of game and shame and guilt. Game and shilt. So that you're not full of shame and guilt for not, you know, I'm not trying to make your life worse for you. But please, these dedication to the homework is a very essential part of knowing the fullness of the experience of this course. So this is your little homework sheet. This is the second aspect of your homework. And it has to do with softening and relaxing. A good idea is to follow your belly around the during the day, because the belly is an indicator of the stress and tension we carry throughout different occasions or situations or events in the day. And if you can just touch in on your belly as a touch point, just relax. You know you're relaxed when it actually moves out when you take an in-breath and moves in when you exhale. If it's not working that way, then because the body works that way, it means the mind's interfering. So you just, and being soft and gentle, relaxing. So maybe when you sit down in a chair, you can just take the first minute of any time you sit down, okay. And then any time you're about to get up, you take that few seconds before you get up and collect yourself, relax yourself, just touch, and then move from a sense of relaxation as you move out into activity. Move from a sense of relaxation back into activity when you come back into sitting. This is any time you sit, not just in the formal sitting. So you constantly reference relaxation and ease and gentleness. Okay? Now the third homework is to establish a second marker. For those who weren't here last week, a marker is a pause that we give life, out of which the next activity we do, we try to do as consciously as we can. A good marker is taking, when you have your keys to your car, right, you can put them in the ignition and then you drop your hand, unless your car starts buzzing, in which case you do it before you put your ignition. But in any case, you put it in and then you just stop for a second. Just take a few seconds and collect yourself, maybe follow your breath, and then let the driving, in exactly the same way as we stopped the formal walking and then asked you to continue the practice coming back into the room up here, you take the pause and then you continue the mindful activity of knowing what you're doing, starting the car and driving as long as you can from that sense of mindfulness. So the pause establishes the collectedness, and then from that collectedness comes the activity. All right. Another one could be brushing your hair or anything. Opening a door, that's a good one. You reach, you touch the door handle and you stop before you open. Can't you pause for 10 seconds? And then when you move into the room and whatever situation awaits for you there, you do it from that sense of collectedness. So that could be a pause. Touching doorknobs. Brushing your hair. Okay, you touch the brush, you just pause for a second. And then brush your hair from that sense, or brushing your teeth. Two that I would like you to establish sometime during the course of these 6 weeks is getting up out of bed. Before you get up out of bed, pause, take a minute, and just follow your breath and get up from that sense of mindfulness. Going to sleep, wasted time. You're not doing anything for those X number of minutes it takes you to get to sleep. Follow your breath into your sleep. It doesn't count for the 30 minutes. But it counts as one of the pauses, one of the markers. So then you just, okay, you just let yourself. And what it'll do is cut down all the worry and way that we usually fall asleep, which is to rehearse and regret and reflect and all the R's. You just, some people find their sleep being deeper and richer from that ability to do that. So does anybody have any question about markers and what they're used for? So the second marker, anybody want to share one of their first markers, what they're doing the first week? Okay, so leave a little reminder, hang a little sign on your dashboard. Okay, you have to bring forth the same effort every day. Every moment you have to wake up to yourself. And wise effort is a very important component part of this. You know, you just can't, because very quickly the mind doesn't want to do it anymore. I tried that, it's not exciting anymore. This is it. What's the next marker I'm going to do? I brushed my teeth now. Make love to your teeth. You can get into it. Get one of those sonic toothbrushes and like... I mean, it can be very interesting. You always know exactly where you're brushing. And you're not doing anything but that activity. So you're recovering. Get a sense of what this does. You're recovering your life within that activity. You're not waiting in anticipation for some other activity, and we have to get over this activity in order for our life to begin. We begin through the activity itself. So you recover your life. Where do we think we live? On the other side of brushing our teeth? We live in the brushing of our teeth. So we have to bring forth effort to live there. We have to wake up while we're there. But that's not how we relate to brushing our teeth. It's something to get over. Come on. God. And everything is that way. Everything is not it for itself, but where it will lead me. What's the product of what I do? It makes us think not where we are, but what the goals that we set. And therefore, we just lose our whole life in the making of these goals and the products we seek, not in the process that we take in getting to the product. So that should just make sense. It should just make basic sense. Like, well, that makes sense. You know, light bulb. But doing it is harder. Doing it is much harder because in doing it, the mind, here's the trick of the mind. The mind only thinks in terms of time. Got to get over this and get to the next thing. It worries about, it'll bring forth the past to worry about the present, or it'll take the present and make it into the future anticipation of where the present is moving. It doesn't fix itself in the present. The heart fixes itself in the present because the only place you can really care is here and now. You can't care about some abstract next moment. So if you want the heart engaged in life, the moment has to be alive for it to engage in. That's what sensitivity is. An engaged quality of the moment. And then you're affected by it. And then you change. And the mind doesn't want to change, and it doesn't want to be affected. It wants to stay just the way it is. And it'll be just this little stubborn little kid. I'm not going to do that. This is boring. Okay. You just be quiet. The world needs our heart, not our mind. That's the state of affairs. And we don't have a lot more centuries to live mentally, technologically sophisticated. Look what we've done in the last century. And look how this one's starting now. It's a time for the heart to come in. You don't lose the mind when you bring the heart out. The mind is balanced with the heart. And so all we're doing is recovering our life and allowing our heart to have a place within it. That's all. Yes. Don't make it. Don't try to force yourself in it. The question is in terms of trying to get over the objections of the mind, right? You don't. You just relax into them. You just relax. When you, how we recover all of this is through relaxation. You don't fight it. You just relax into it. If you relax right now fully, you would be in an awakened state. Fully. That means the mind isn't losing context of the relaxing. Everything's relaxing together. Right? So, in a fully relaxed state, the moment is. It doesn't have to battle anything. The mind is always going to complain about not having its say. That will be forever the way it's complaining. The mind is a conditioned machine that looks for a better world than the one that is at hand. That's what it's conditioned to do, to search out the universe for better worlds to conquer, not the world we're in. That's what it's learned to do. And so you sit down and it says, I don't like this. There must be something better I can bring to bear than just this. The pain in my knee is not good enough. It's not cool enough in the room. We've got to create more lighting, less people, right? Then you do all of that, and it still complains. It doesn't settle. And so you give up on that. That's not the way to do it. So then you just relax with it and let it yell and scream, oh, this is boring. This, okay. Okay, I can hold that. So it's boring. So what? And then it's not boring anymore. As soon as you are unswayed by the messages of the mind's pull, the mind has no pull. When I used to fast one day a week. And for the longest period of time, this was many, many years ago, I couldn't get through the day. I'd get, you know, till 4 o'clock and then I would. And so every time I would start to do it again, the mind knew didn't have the resolve and it would play out, don't you want to? Oh, no, I'm going to fast. No, you really don't want. Then one day I made it through. And then I made it through again. And then I thought, okay, I'm never going to, this is it. When I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And the mind shut off because it knew it couldn't play that theme to get me to. When it's come to the end of the theme, when it knows the resolve is stronger than the theme, it gives up the theme. Like in bed, twitching, turning, turning. I'm not going to move. I'm just going to lie here. You twitch. I'm not going to twitch. But you got to twitch. You've always twitched. 30 years of twitching. You can't stop twitching on me. I'm not twitching. Okay, well, I'll try something else.
My name's stupid.
Other questions or comments? Yes.
More specific, like when I was sitting on the chair, I was finding I could feel my belly better than when I'm sitting in this sort of lotus position on the cushion, although I find that
right.
Am I not high enough? Or is that
the question is, he finds himself better able to feel his breath on a chair than on a cushion. You know, there are going to be times when no matter how we sit, we're going to feel it very well, and times when we're not going to feel it very well. It's not often a function of where we sit. It's a function of what's going on in that particular state of mind in relationship to it. But play with different, the importance of sitting, and you can sit as well in a chair and meditate as you can on the floor. It's not nobler or second-class meditation for you to be on a chair. So find a position in which you can remain relatively comfortable and straight and relaxed and at ease so that there isn't, you know, the gripping pain of some tendon being stretched and all that. And then, no matter where you're going to sit, the mind is going to come at you. That's a given. And at some point it's going to be difficult, and sometimes it's going to be easy, and that's a given. And the fact that it was easier, very easy yesterday, does not in any way mean it's going to also be easy today. In fact, it could be harder for the next 10 days. But the graph of all the peaks and valleys slopes upward. It's just not a linear straight graph. It's like this. So over time and over a long period of time, you'll notice changes in how, in your ability to accommodate, work with pain, sustain your attention upon things, etc. So it doesn't really matter what physical posture you're in, and I would play with both postures, but I wouldn't just, once you've chosen a posture for 30 minutes, stay in that posture and work with it. Okay? Yes.
You said something about the status of the preliminary lesson. That's a meditation for decades. Facts are friendly, and yet some facts in the moment are not so friendly. So they're preliminary lessons, but they're also lessons that sound like you learned.
Yes, absolutely. Question is about the lessons and whether they're preliminary or long enduring. They're long enduring. They aren't something you get over and then you start to meditate. The lessons will enrich in themselves in meaning and in insight all along the way. And they will mean something more to you the next time you do them if you begin to address them as we go. But you have to have an orientation in that direction for the meditation to work at all. You have to be willing to go and put your mind aside and to say, okay, enough thinking, let me come back to the breath. Or to go to the itch and say, okay, let me just feel this itch for a few minutes instead of just scratching it. Let me just touch this pain with softness and kindness for just a few minutes here rather than getting up and bolting from it. So the direction has to be towards the fact. And then you'll uncover the richness of the facts with each, really with each movement of meditation itself, they'll become richer and richer. Last question, yes. Yes.
Well, I guess I'm kind of confused between letting the mind go and concentrating on the breath, or kind of pulling my focus in, controlling the mind to focus on the breath.
Question is about letting the mind go or pulling the mind into focus. There's a confusion about that. What you're doing is releasing the thought, thinking, and coming back and focusing the mind, not thought, but focusing your attention. That's not thinking. Focusing your attention on the experience, the actual physical experience, the rub, the belly moves. That's what we're focusing on, not thinking about. Thinking is what we're releasing ourselves from. What we're releasing ourselves into is the actual contact of the experience. Those are two very different things, and sometimes they take a while to understand the difference between those. So that was a good question. Okay, now I'd like to just wrap up the evening, if I could, with just another, for those who weren't here last week, about Dana, because D-A-N-A, the Dana basket that's out there, is my make a living, really. The money that you paid, the $50, pays for the room, pays for the day long that you've done in the room and the rental of all that, and keeps Sims running. But none of that money comes to me. And so I put a Donna basket out, not as an extra tax, because if you can't afford it, you can come free and you don't have to give Donna. Nobody's going to check that off. But if it's meaningful to you and you would like to give, it's the what supports me in my teaching. I'm totally dependent upon your generosity to pay my bills and to live. And that's just how this particular tradition works. So if you would remember that, I would deeply appreciate it. And that basket will be out every week. Okay, everyone have their homework. Everyone know what they're doing, at least to get us through until next week. try to arrive on time, if at all possible, next week, because we'll sit from 7 to 7:30, and I'll give the instructions in the first 15 minutes of that period. And I look forward to seeing you then.